Hi everyone, this is Catherine and welcome to the First Times Summer Series in which we are revisiting some of our most popular and favourite episodes. As you'll already know if you've listened to the Season 6 finale, Kate and I are taking a break from the First Time in its current format in 2024. But don't delete the feed just yet. I will be back in March with something new and slightly different. It'll still feature interviews with writers, but there'll be other creatives, comedians and entrepreneurs involved as well. One last thing before we get into this particular interview. To celebrate 6 seasons of the podcast and to kick off the coach salting work I'm doing for writers this year, I'm posting a series about what I've learned on the podcast, particularly about interviewing and being interviewed these past few years on Instagram. You can check it out at Catherine Collette Writer. I'll put a link in the show notes. This is the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
This guest has been on my wish list for a long time, and I was thrilled to speak to the ultimate slashy writer, actor, producer, director, Alison Bell, over Zoom a month or so back. Alison Bell is the co-creator, co-writer, producer, director, and star of the award-winning ABC and Netflix co-production, The Letdown. Together with her co-writer, Sarah Scheller, Alison won the 2016 Actor Award for Best Television Screenplay and about a bazillion other awards, including Alison herself as Best Comedy Performer, and you can find the full list of acclaim in our show notes. In 2021, Alison developed and led the writing team on the critically acclaimed binge series Love Me. The show picked up 7 Logie nominations. She also wrote and starred in an episode of Summer Love, an ABC anthology series, and in the ABC drama Significant Others. She has worked as an assessor for Playwriting Australia, a script consultant on theatre productions and short films, and has contributed pieces to Marie Claire and Vogue Australia. She's worked with production companies both here and in the US, including Sharon Horgan's Merman, which blows my mind, Endemol Shine, and a whole lot more. Prior to making The Letdown, Alison was best known for her dramatic work on the stage, for which she won multiple Helpman and Green Room Awards, as well as her starring role in the Actor Award-winning comedy Laid. She's guest starred in many Australian series, and her US credits include HBO's The Leftovers, No Activity for CBS All Access, and the reboot of Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories on Apple TV. Alison is currently appearing on stage in What If Only as part of an MTC double bill. Alison Bell, you've been on my interview wish list for some time now, so it is an absolute thrill to finally be speaking to you. And might I add, and people probably say this to you all the time, quite strange to be seeing your face on my screen when I have just immersed myself in watching you on my screen for so long. So welcome to the First Time podcast. Yeah,
to join you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm alarmed that I've been on. I've seen the illustrious list of writers on your podcast, and I'm alarmed and deeply humbled to
be neither of those
joining
things.
Them.
So we're going to talk about lots of things. As I said, I've been watching you on screen and watching things that you've worked on screen and loving them and both laughing out loud and interrupting everyone in my household and also crying at different points. But before we do that, I want to go back to the young Alison Bell. And I want to ask, how and when did you catch the storytelling bug?
I think it actually happened really young. I remember in primary school, I have very few memories of primary school. Don't know what was going on for me, but very few memories. But I remember very strongly my desire to be a story writer. That was what, you know, and the kids are like, what do you want to be, you know? People want to be something heroic. I wanted to be a story writer. So that was from, I reckon, about grade 2, probably about 7 years old. So it was always kind of there. And I wonder if it was from my curious early years. My parents moved out. They're both teachers, and we lived out in the country when I was born in country New South Wales, a tiny town called Grenfell. And Mum and Dad were very involved in community stuff, and Mum and Dad were involved in the Dramatic Society. So from the time I was tiny, I was going to see shows, and Dad would do the set building and Mum would be in the, you know, chorus or whatever. So story was around and performance was around from a very young age. And I don't know why me out of the three of my siblings, but because the others have sensible jobs. Yeah, it was in me from the beginning, and I was a really shy kid, and I think there's something about escaping into worlds through stories that was very appealing.
That's really interesting, the shyness part of it. Was the storytelling in the written form, or were you already doing the kind of dramatic storytelling, going for laughs, being the storyteller around the kitchen table? Was that part of it?
No. It was the written form when I was young, absolutely. And it slowly became performative. I wasn't the one around the kitchen table telling the hilarious stories. That was my sister. She's a very funny woman, still is. But high school, I started to get the bug, I think. I started to realize that I could be other people, you know. And that's when I actually remember year seven drama, when we had to do some improvisation and I started getting laughs. And that was such a curious feeling for a shy kid.
And addictive. Curious,
magnificent. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like many creatives or people who find themselves in creative industries, first you went and attempted to do something more sensible and you went and did, you know, arts law, and then you went to drama school. So yeah. Can you tell us about your kind of move into acting on the stage, maybe how you got your first gig and what that buzz continued to be for you?
Yeah. You mean through my early years?
Yeah.
So high school, I did drama all through school, and I would do the school musicals, and just that I was living my best life in that, you know, in that world. And it was, a lot of my friends were the artsy kind of smart kids, and we just had an absolute ball doing all that stuff. I was doing the, you know, the Young Shakespearean, the Shakespeare competition and all of these things. And that was my joy. Absolutely. But I liked the learning stuff as well, just the academic side of things. And so I wanted to go to university, but while I was at university, I was doing plays. I was doing stuff at Canberra Rep. I was doing stuff on campus, and I was doing stuff with a little company, like a youth theatre company in Canberra. There's a lot of that stuff in Canberra because there's not much to do. Or when I was growing up there wasn't heaps to do. So you had to, and you had to find ways to make life entertaining. And I did it that way. So I was very engaged all through my degree in that stuff. And I knew there was a little voice that was going, you should give it a go, give it a go, give it a go. And I also knew that if I quite enjoyed law to the later years of my degree. And I knew that if I started down that path, it was such a clear path. Mm. And there was something daunting about starting in that field and getting sucked in and getting used to the consistency of work and all those things that go with normal jobs. So I knew I couldn't start. It was as simple as that. And all of those early theatre experiences led me to kind of believe that I would be better suited to the other world. But I remember, like, just going back a bit further, I remember I was obsessed with Bell Shakespeare when I was at high school, because they visited Canberra. They always came to Canberra. And I would have been in year 8 or 9, I reckon, when I saw two productions, my first two Shakespeare productions. And I remember thinking, imagine being able to make someone feel how I'm feeling.
Mm.
Like there was that exchange, that being completely overwhelmed with wonder and awe and joy and all the human emotions that the story entailed. It was such, I felt that as such a gift, that it was really an exciting thing to pursue, to be able to give that back to audiences. So, yeah, it kind of started back then.
I'm really interested as a daughter of two teachers myself and also someone who both wanted to do, you know, writing and film when I left school and then was convinced that neither of those were actual valid kind of choices to do and went on to do other things and teaching and the rest of it. This idea of already feeling like you could give it a crack in a non-normal job, how much support did you have around you to think, I'm going to give it a crack even though I know that potentially this is not a path that will be, you know, financially sustainable for me for the rest of my life?
Look, I think I was very lucky to have the family I have. I'm the youngest, so I've got an architect brother and a lawyer sister. Like they kind of did the heavy lifting for me there.
As shown by the incline of your head and the kind of raise of the eyebrows there.
But I also think, like, I absolutely I benefited from them, from their choices, and they liberated me in a way. And I think that, you know, as a parent, I can understand too that there would be a more relaxed quality in the parenting of the third as opposed to the first. But that said, I do think my parents are unusually open for their generation that it, in terms of my career choice. Neither of them did what they wanted to do. My dad wanted to be a vet. Mum wanted to be a speech pathologist. They both could only go to uni if they got scholarships, they become teachers, you know, and they made the best of that. But I think they understand that compromise. And so, and I think they saw that joy in me.
Those years on the stage when you were first doing stage work and theatre work, how did you make that work for you? Were you always in work? Were you having to hustle really hard? How did those years work?
Yeah, the early years out of drama school I was lucky, and it is about luck. It's also about talent and a talent for being okay with this lifestyle, I think. But I was exceptionally lucky. I got offered a job before I graduated, like at graduation. I got offered a job at the Melbourne Theatre Company, and work begets work. That's a truism. So getting on the stage really quickly after graduating helped me get other work. But of course there were gaps, even though I was sort of viewed as the one, you know, one of the ones who had early success. There were huge gaps in between theatre gigs. I mean, they're three months of the year. And if you get one a year, that's seen as a real coup, you know. So I was always working in other jobs. I worked at the Waiters Club in Melbourne. A lot of people who live in Melbourne probably know it. It's an institution. And that they were just, I should call out to Dennis, the owner. He was a real supporter. You know, I could come and go. I'd do a gig and then I'd go and waitress in between, or I did some paralegal work and, you know, used my old degree to kind of do that stuff. I was working in between and I was always slightly panicked in between. Like I've never been someone who has settled in the unemployed times or had this kind of feeling that it will be okay. I was always worried about what was going to come next. But things did come. And so I had a steady-ish stream, certainly through those early years. And it wasn't until I got pregnant that stream dried up a bit.
Okay, tell us about this, because I want to move into the writing and particularly the letdown. And I know that you talked about this, that for women in the industry, it's kind of this not so invisible barrier that the work dries up. So what happened then when you did get pregnant, and why does this happen, and is it still happening, Alison?
Look, I hope it's not still happening. I imagine it is. It gets really hard with kids, and I think people know that. I think people know that on both sides. I think the employers know that, and I think we performers know that. I didn't know it before I had a kid, but I certainly know it now. but I also think it coincided with the motherhood thing. Like, I have heard people say, oh, didn't she have a baby? And it was 3 years ago, you know, kind of ruling people out. But that was a few years ago now. I don't know if that's still happening. But alternatively, I also hear this narrative of, you know, people taking work 2 weeks after giving birth. And that breaks my heart, because I also did that and I know the cost. So it's a brutal reality for performers, I think, having to face either saying no and then just a string of doors closing, like terrible metaphor, but you kind of get locked out for a while if people go, oh no, she's not taking work at the, you know, she's having a baby, and that can go for years. Alternatively, throwing yourself straight in and what that, I shouldn't speak for other people. Maybe other people are far more robust in that sense, but I feel like the cost to myself. And I mean, I was lucky enough to have a partner who was a co-parent, but so few people are still in that position. So we could manage, but I still feel the loss of not having that time to settle into motherhood. And the great irony is I was writing about it. But I do think it still exists. I mean, to tell a story, I told a colleague when I was 6 weeks pregnant that I was pregnant because we just had the photo shoot for a show. And I was telling them in advance just to kind of go, can we do something with the photo where I'm not front and center, just in case this pregnancy goes to full term and I can't do the show. And I was told I would be replaced immediately, but not even waiting for the 3 months. And this is a story I shouldn't really be telling, but my agent, I got really distressed, and my agent negotiated that they wait.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of stuff. Imagine, like, I just think about the tragedy of miscarrying is one thing, but imagine like miscarrying and all your work disappearing because you dared to try and give people a heads up and just go, hey, can we just shuffle the poster image? Can we just change the poster image a bit? So that stuff happened then. That was 2014 or 13. And I hope it's not happening now, but I fear it probably still is.
Let's talk about the writing of the letdown and all the motherhood stuff. There's a great interview that you did with Gemma Birrell for The Secret Life of Writers, which is a terrific podcast, where you talk about all the unfinished screenplays on your computer, but you reveal that the letdown was the first one that you actually finished. And you say in that there's nothing better for learning than doing. So I want to ask, how did the writing of the letdown come about, and where do you begin? How does this writing of a screenplay practically happen?
I know that's the question, isn't it? Because I now look back on my younger self and go, why didn't you do it? Why didn't you start all of those ideas when you were straight out of drama school and had the space? Now I have no space.
And I'm trying to do it.
You fool, you had endless time. Yeah. But, so the beginning is a really good question. I feel like it was this curious serendipity that happened. I was watching my beloved sister parent, and she has three children, and she's a really accomplished, like just a, you know, a really good human being and a lawyer, as I said. And it was just, I was just seeing all the challenges that I had never, ever seen on screen. And I think my mum was so tired in her child rearing days that she's almost forgotten. So she didn't tell those stories. And I was watching it going, this is invisible. This is the depiction of motherhood on screen never shows this. And so I started getting really passionate about that. At the same time, and this is really in politics, and I know there are probably consequences of me saying it, but I was also reading scripts sometimes that didn't reflect women in the way that I knew them. Mm. And that's no one's fault. It's because there weren't enough men in leadership women in leadership positions. And I believe that men weren't previously raised to empathize with the female experience because they didn't have to, because every protagonist was male. You know, all of our stories were male. So it's no one's fault, but it just started to frustrate me that I was reading these scripts going, women don't talk like that, or whatever my criticism was, that people don't like to hear. Anyway, that happened at a time when I had just done the show Laid, and my director on Laid, Trent O'Donnell, his wife, Sarah Scheller, we were seeing a little bit of them, and Sarah had mentioned she had two babies, very close together in age, and she was talking about how she'd really like to do a mother's group. Like, mother's group was, ripe for comedy. And I went, what? I really want to write a political thing about women, the truth about motherhood. And it was just that started it. Like, I'd been dabbling, I'd been writing, but I wasn't backing myself at all. Like, I don't know why, but I didn't feel like there was permission for me to do it, and I no longer wait for permission. But, the industry doesn't give you permission often, so you do have to some extent, get it. But there was just this moment of going, we have an idea that complements, we have ideas that complement each other. Mm-hmm. And we sat down and started doing it. And it was because I had a partner in that made me do it. It was because I was beholden to someone else, and I was responsible for completing a scene or for doing, instead of just by myself in my bedroom typing something for me and going, I don't know. it became a conversation, and I think that got me to finish the screenplay, definitely.
That's so great, because so often writers who are writing book form projects are not collaborating. But we've talked recently to Amy Kaufman, who collaborates with various different people at different times, and she's just so excited about what comes out of writing collaborations. And I'm obsessed with this idea, both of a bigger writer's room, but also of how you do this process. So with you and Sarah, did it involve planning out things, mapping things out together, just spitballing with each other? What did it look like, this collaboration?
Yeah, that's exactly what it looked like. It started with, we found common ground in terms of shows and comedy that we both enjoyed. Mm. And so we knew tonally what we wanted to do. We knew tonally we didn't want women wearing makeup, waking up in the morning. Mm. The aesthetic was very clear from the start that it was going to be a lot more stripped back than what we were used to seeing on our screens. And there were a lot of shows that we had in common in terms of what we enjoyed. So we kind of established the tone very quickly, and I think that's really key to any collaboration. And then it was just ideas. It was storytelling. Even though I say as a child I wasn't the one at the kitchen table, now I am. I mean, Sarah and I would just tell each other stories from our lives, from our friends' lives, and we'd kind of write that down or talk about particular women we knew and the qualities in them. And that started to become the basis of those characters. It's interesting because one character we found quite hard to write, and she was the one character that neither of us knew in real life. So it was all born of real life and sharing all these ideas, and then doing that's the labor, I think, in TV screenwriting, because of what we're asked to do, what we're asked to give networks before a script is even written, is this arc of every character, of the entire story, of what's going to happen. And I find that really arse about. Like, there's no kind of freedom to follow where the writing goes, and that's, I think, where I would prefer to go as a writer. But we did have to map everything out. So it was a matter of, like, looking at issues. Like, I read a lot in that time. Mm. I wasn't a mother at that time. I was pregnant during that process. And so I was reading everything and really looking at what women were talking about and what the issues were that hadn't been discussed. And they were the things that we started to focus on. So it was contrived in that way, but it was also fed by real life and what we were watching our friends and family members go through.
The process of this happening is so interesting. And of course, there's so many parallels with writing a novel or taking a project through. Do you map out the series as a whole in terms of those characters' arcs? Like, are you looking at, okay, yes, this is the potential for the whole series?
Yeah.
And at what point, you talked about networks then, at what point are you pausing to say, these are potential actors that we get in, this is potential funding? Like, do you write the whole thing first on hope and prayer?
No. Well, no, we didn't. We actually did write a pilot episode, and that's we gave a pilot and a what they call a mini Bible to the ABC.
What's in the mini Bible? I have to ask.
The mini Bible is like a précis of the entire story. So that's what's wild. Like, it takes a lot of work to work
huge
out the entire story of a, you know, 3 hour. It ends up being, you know, about 3 hours, but it's, you know, it's more than a movie.
Yes.
So to plot out that for every character to get a good sense of where they're all going to go is a lot of work. So we did all, and you do most of that labor for free, which is not ideal. And admittedly, we did get a little bit of funding along the way because we were with Giant Dwarf. So they applied for funding and we could work, you know, to kind of help us along the way. But the mini Bible, yeah, like a précis of the entire story, themes, all the main characters. We had to have a clear idea of who they were, what their stories were going to be. I think we kind of would write a paragraph on why this needs to happen now, this that kind of thing. So it's a document that really is the entire project. It's worth, like, trying to sell its value, but also a lot of detail in there.
Mm.
And, of course, those details changed when we got down to the nitty-gritty. And when a network comes on board anyway, they want to feed into it. But that's essentially what a mini-Bible is. And
so you've got the mini-Bible and you shoot the pilot. You shoot that first episode.
No, we just wrote the pilot.
You just wrote it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at that point, you go for a producer, funding, the rest of it.
Well, we got funding along the way with Giant Dwarf to write the Bible and the pilot. So that's based on the idea and kind of an even smaller version of that mini Bible. Like, you've got to do that. You've got to pitch those ideas to the funding bodies to get the money. And to be honest with you, I can't remember if Giant Dwarf gave us some money from their reserves to help us develop it, or whether they applied for. I'm far more in tune with that stuff now, but this was the first time I was doing any of this stuff. So I was quite naive as to the processes. But, yeah, so we got a little bit of cash along the way, but sometimes you just give a Bible, or, you know, you don't necessarily need to have written the pilot. And it's all changing now with the streamers coming in. They've got really particular ideas about how it should go, and it's heavily influenced. From what I'm seeing now, it's heavily influenced from the American experience.
Mm.
Having had the American experience, you know, a small American experience. I lived over there for a bit. I now can see the influence of we're being asked to pitch now in a similar way to how I was being asked to pitch over there, which was radically different to Australia. But now it's quite aligned.
So what does that involve, Alison? When you say it's radically different, like, what is that experience of what you're pitching?
We had to work out 3 seasons worth of Sarah and I sold an idea over there, and that was a very lengthy income-less process.
Yeah.
I don't know how people survive over there, because it was really taxing, and Yeah. Rent became an issue, you know, like that. It was, yeah. But we were asked to work out three seasons worth of a series, plotting. And that's, you know, that's an extraordinary amount of work to speculate on. And we had to, so you had to write a mini Bible essentially. But then we had to condense it into a speech, a performance. Wow. So we had to learn, we had to write like it was about 20 pages, I think, of banter back and forth and a presentation. And we had to learn that off by heart. And you would go into a room. This is, we did this with producers first. And then once we got producers on board, we then developed the show more and then did it for the networks and streamers. You learnt this speech and you walked into a room and you did a show. And people would literally go, okay, go, and sit there. And we'd all be pretending that we were having, Sarah and I were having a chat and just speaking off the cuff when they all know that we've learnt off by
Oh my goodness, that is blowing my mind.
It was, as a performer, it was okay. Like, yeah. I know how to tell a joke five times, you yeah. know, and keep it fresh. But as a human being who just likes a chat, it was bizarre to me. And that's what I've heard. I haven't actually pitched to an Australian streamer yet, but what I've heard is that's what you're doing now. I ran into someone recently and he was like, yeah, it was so good. It was on Zoom. I could have my script up there to do the speech. And I was like, oh no, we're doing speeches here now.
Wow. This is wild. It's just like walking into an entirely different industry. That is extraordinary.
It felt like that moving from Australia too, because the chats I had with the ABC were so just friendly chats. You talk about it. You talk about ideas.
Yeah.
And it was all in here, but I didn't feel like I had to, you know, I couldn't say, I didn't feel like I couldn't like pause for a second and go, well, let me think about that. Like, I think there's such an efficiency productivity drive in the States that, you know, you've got your 20 minute slot, get all the information out. Do not waste anyone's time, sell it, you know, go. That feels like where it comes from. And it's I preferred a leisurely chat.
Yes. Wow. Wow. On the letdown and the States, because obviously, you know, it went off here. I remember watching it. My kids were a little bit bigger then, and my group of friends kind of had all the way down to newborns, and some just couldn't watch.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, whoa, this is right where I am. But just it obviously just hit the right nerve for so many viewers, and then in the US as well. When did you realize that you'd really nailed it? That you'd nailed those characters, you'd nailed the motherhood stuff. When did that kind of dawn on you?
I think it was the personal messages I started to get from people I didn't know. I remember sitting I went to do a voiceover not long after it, and I think it was just after the pilot had been aired, and I sat next to an actress, and there was a look in her face like she had a baby, and it wasn't just I had a laugh. It was something else was going on for her. And then, and she talked about the show for a sec, and then she wrote me this message, and it was the most beautiful, moving, not to, I mean, you know, I don't mean to pretend this is we did the greatest thing ever, but we didn't, we just told some honest stories, but it felt like it was needed. And that made me really proud. Like that even if she was the only person who did that, that was really important to me, because it's about that feeling that I had when I was 14 in a theater, someone telling a story that really landed for me. And to know that it had really landed for her, and that she felt like it had said a lot of things that she wasn't able to acknowledge openly, or that she felt she'd been very alone in those feelings. And that was my experience of motherhood too. I felt quite, I was lucky I had Sarah
as my colleague during the writing of that, and I have my sister who was an extraordinary resource. But I was quite isolated, and I was working so much, and I had all these big feelings, and I had all the isolation from my old peers and friends, and all I was experiencing all those things. So it was also cathartic, you know. But and I have this belief that if you're going through it, someone else has. Mm. Like we're not unique. We're all so similar. And so it was when those kind of messages started coming through. It was when I would be in the park with my kid and people would come up and talk to me. And that happened for quite a long time, and in the two different countries. So I knew that one, I knew that people were watching, which was a relief. But two, I knew that it was landing because people were telling me that's my life. Mm-hmm. And the number of people who kind of do that joke of like, did you have cameras in my house? You know, I'm like,
yeah,
no, we're all the same.
We are all the same, but you're right too, that the isolation, it doesn't matter how big your support network is and how honest you feel you're being, you know, with other mothers or other parents. I was rewatching the start of season two last night with the party, and, you know, having both the feeling of, oh my gosh, you know, like, what have you done? The hair, the cake, all of the things. And that at the same time, you know, kind of recognizing, just going straight back in my head to the night before my daughter's first birthday and going, you were mad. Like, you were a person who is not a real human. Like, what even were those pressures in your mind? Why were you doing what you did? What were you thinking? And that there's a level of truth telling that is more than we can perhaps do person to person. That is the gift of what we get on screen in the show.
Oh, that makes me, that's so lovely to hear. I think that also part of it is I'm interested in understanding why people do what they do, not just seeing what they do. And I think the comedy is seeing what they do. But my hope was that by just showing the situation, by just showing a woman who has to drive around at night to get her kid to sleep, like, there maybe we'll start to understand why she's mad, like why we're all a bit mad, and that's entirely okay and normal. Yes. And, you know, because who can survive that early, you know, that first year without, if you don't have a sleeping child and if you don't have support and if you don't have whatever the challenges are, they all have repercussions, and our sanity seems to go first. But also the cultural pressures, like that's also really interesting to me, like the social kind of stuff that is sort of in so many of us. I think passed down generationally.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very interesting delineation you make between the comedy is seeing what they do and then the other part of it is seeing why, because it is delicious the way that you can move us so quickly from laugh out loud to gut punching kind of sadness and moments. Do you think that is, and it's probably a bit of both, this instinctive kind of storytelling in you back from those days of watching what Fell Shakespeare could make you feel? And or is there a certain level of knowing, okay, I've got an audience for 20, however many minutes, and I need to take them to these 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 emotional registers, and I need to do it in this order? Like,
I don't think I was particularly conscious of the latter. Okay. My storytelling very much comes from character. So I had a partner who was really good at reminding me it had to be funny, which was great. Because I was in it. Her kids were a little bit older and I had a baby. So I easily have just sobbed in every episode.
Yes. I see how this would happen.
But also, you know, I did get into this rhythm of going, this has just happened to me personally, and I'm having a cry, and now how can I make it funny? Like, but I think that's also a personality thing. I think, and it's a cultural thing. I think
I find people a little bit tedious if they're just leaning on the earnest experience in their storytelling. I like to dress mine up with a bit of a laugh, you know, like it, my tragedies, my mini tragedies have to be funny in the retelling. That's yeah. how I am as a human. So I kind of felt like that's what we needed to do in the show. We needed, but never lose sight of what's underneath. Mm. I don't know that we always got that right, to be honest, but I do feel like it was important that we keep coming back to why, mm. why these women are doing these things mm. and we tell the truth about the why. Mm. Otherwise the comedy, and I find that the comedy's a little bit, I don't know, not so satisfying if there's nothing underneath them. Mm. You know, they're just gags. I'm not that interested. I kind of get tired. Like, funny, great, I love a laugh, but then I kind of go, what for? So I'm far more interested in what's driving people underneath.
This feels like the kind of Alison Bell sweet spot, because the other thing that I watched last week was the wonderful ep that you did of the ABC anthology series Summer Love, Hannah and Alex. Which is just terrific and had me at both ends of the emotional register as well. And there's this fabulous moment where we get the line, middle age is a bit shit, isn't it? And I was thinking that it was just, and because I was watching all this stuff at the same time, that it's just this beautiful kind of, I felt like, oh, you're just here for me. Alison Bell's just here for me. She's going to take me through all the way through. Like, if we could now move into kind of the 50s and the 60s, if you could be there doing our aged care kind of homes in the 70s and 80s, that would be great. Do you find the stories that you're telling are changing as your experiences change, or is the kind of motherload of material the same for you all the time and you keep returning to it just in different forms?
I think it's changing slightly as I get older, and because I'm interested in what's not being said on telly. So that requires observation mm. right now. Mm. But TV can be quite slow. So, you know, I've got projects that I had in development for ages, and then you go, oh, it's not that, it's gone. Mm. That moment's gone. Mm. But Summer Love was quite quick, and I don't think that stuff has been fully explored, and I'd like to explore it further. Like, I think you can tell stories in as, you know, in as many ways as you can imagine. So we can keep digging into that material so long as it's still relevant, so long as it is still kind of a quandary, you know, the conundrum of life. If it's in women's lives, then I'm interested in it. But, you know, even I do think there are other things that I'm interested in looking at. Like, there are big, broad themes that I love. I do like family. I think family explains a lot about every human being. When you meet someone's parents and you go, now I get it. Yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I love that sort of stuff. So that it was important to us in the letdown to have the mother figure there and to learn a bit about her family and to see his family. You know, that was important to see what made these two people mm. make the assumptions that they made of each other mm. and of themselves, mm. The reactions and the kind of compliance that people have within their own families. Mm. And Love Me was a great opportunity yes. to do that too, in a different form. But I find that kind of our relationship to our parents and grandparents and, you know, where we've come from, is so strongly kind of, creates the path that we take. You mm. know, it's very hard to step off the path that we've sort of been put on. Mm. So I'm endlessly interested in exploring that stuff. And you get a bit of that in the Summer Love ep as well. Mm. And sometimes I like to make, you know, I hope in my career I continue to be allowed, because you do, I can't just write for myself, mm. allowed to explore it in a funny way and also in a dramatic way. Like, I don't want to always be being asked to make everyone laugh all the time. Like, mm. that kind of gets I've written a lot of comedy that hasn't been seen, you know, through the COVID years. I did some projects and wrote so much stuff. And it's hard work. It's really hard work writing comedy. And drama feels, drama with a sense of humour feels like a nicer place for me to sit, like an easier, the flow is a lot easier for me there.
In Love Me, which I've also been watching and loving, and I wanted to ask you specifically, and this is just because I'm really interested to know, how your writing has changed to incorporate the full kind of filmic aspect, I suppose. And I'm thinking particularly of the extraordinary scene where Hugo Weaving is in the bin at the Selvos, and just how that looks on screen, the lead up to it, like just the perfection of the execution of that entire scene and the look of it. How do you conceive that in your head and then get it down on the page for it to look like that?
Look, that's where collaboration comes in, because my interest, I mean, I think you do learn a lot by doing and being thrown in the deep end with the letdown, because we were effectively accidental showrunners on that.
Mm-hmm.
I was across every aspect of that show and learning and asking so many questions of people outside the show itself to understand how to do things, because I was supposed to be doing these things. So there was the steepest of learning curves that I'm extremely grateful for on that show, because a lot of writers get kept out of it. Mm. They get a hand in their script and bye-bye. And I find that quite discombobulating now. Love Me, I wasn't on set. And so that is entirely the purview of the director and the cinematographer. So they really, I wrote the emotional space and they conceived the visuals for it and did a beautiful job of that. We also had a great template in the original, because the original is a Swedish show. It's a beautiful show. It's real, you know. I took on that project as an adaptation because I tonally loved it. It was in terrain that I was really interested in, and it had figures that that we don't often see in Australian stories, you know, a kind of a beta male and a family that were these sort of high achievers who were struggling emotionally. You know, I don't think we tell that story very often. I don't know why we don't, but we don't. And often we're not allowed to be honest, to be completely honest. Like if you write a character, there's a lot of fear around alienating people, alienating audiences. And so I remember when we pitched Esther in The Letdown as to work in the finance sector, the feedback was, I don't know that people will like that. You know, maybe she could have a startup. Like she could have, you know, like it was sort of like,
wow.
And that on those things, you got to pick your battles. But I was like, no, absolutely not. She is a woman in finance. They exist and they have children. End of discussion. And I, you know, it's irrelevant who that feedback came from, but it is out there. Those kind of things about softening the women and softening the, you know. So I liked being able to write different women and different men in that story, and because there was an existing product that the networks could see was a success. It worked having these kind of men and these kind of women. It was like they'd already sold, the Swedes had sold them on the idea, which was great. And I could just come in and go, now we'll do it the Australian way. but yeah, sorry, I'm gone a long way from your question.
I love it.
It was about the cinematic qualities of it. You do get a lot smarter as a writer if you're allowed on set to see how things work. And I was on set for all of The Letdown, and I was in the edit room for all of The Letdown. And I learnt how you can get smarter at telling stories through visuals. I've still got so much learning to do on that front. And I learned from what I saw with Emma and Earl, the director and cinematographer, and Love Me, like what I then, and I would have loved to have been there, but that was a complicated shoot. And, but I learned a lot in the viewing.
Mm.
And I also learned, you also learn to trust, and I think I've always had this in me because I am an actor, you learn to trust actors. Like I would have conversations with Hugo, you know, Hugo and Heather and Sarah Pierce, those three in particular, and just say, don't say it. Don't say, if you can do it in a look, please do that.
Mm.
Don't say those, you know, and they were beautiful because they were like, oh, no. But I think that's part of it too, that you don't always need all the words, because we would find in the letdown edits that we'd cut half the words because you could do, sometimes it was funny to say all the things because saying is sometimes where the joke is. But sometimes you didn't need that whole scene that was written to kind of make it really clear to whoever the reader was on reading the page what was happening. You know, human expression is so much more complex and nuanced than just the words coming out of our mouth. So if you can capture that, great actors can do so much in their eyes that they don't need all the words. I'm constantly learning that and trying to get my scripts and my dialogue as pared back as possible, and leaving it to the actor to kind of communicate the rest.
That is such great advice that can be used and crossed over in different ways. On adaptations, I know because I've been deep diving on you and your work that there have been a couple of Australian books, particularly I'm thinking of Holly Throsby's Goodwood and Melanie Cheng's Australia Day, that you've been involved in the start of or development of adaptation.
Yeah.
What's the process when you're working from book to potentially screen? What's that adaptation like for you?
They were very different processes.
Mm.
I think one, I was so attached to the characters that Melanie wrote that I almost slavishly stuck to them in the adaptation. And that may not have served a screen adaptation. With Goodwood, I felt like we were actively encouraged to depart a lot more. And that was kind of the second book that I was looking at. So it was sort of a progression in my idea of adaptation as well. So they were very different processes. And I think because there is, I think that those books are really great contrasts actually to look at, because Melanie's work, I was trying to weave a whole bunch of stories together. And we don't do that kind of episodic, we don't do that we haven't done a lot of anthology kind of style shows. So the first idea was to make an anthology, and the second was that no network's going to do that. There's a real aversion to it, and Summer Love did it, but there is generally in the industry a real aversion to it because they think people get attached to characters and they want to stay on their journey. So when you drop the character and you ask people to start again every episode, it's asking something of an audience that they're not accustomed to doing. So there is a natural resistance to that. So I had to let go of that anthology idea, and I had to really weave something together. When it came to Goodwood, we were talking about mystery. And there is such a rich history of mystery on TV that it then became an exercise in how do we do this in a way that is going to surprise when our audiences are flooded with mystery stories. So it became a different exercise because books, you know, novels, you get the opportunity to tell story in a radically different way. You can be quiet, you can be internal, all those things. Whereas on the screen, the demands are very different. And I'd love to just have an interview with you where I ask you a whole bunch of questions about writing the internal, you know, the internal kind of stories of characters rather than the external.
Well, it's so interesting too from a writing perspective, because we so rarely get to, I mean, we're taught as you know, authors, to at no stage until basically you're on a red carpet does one get excited about the idea of their book or their work being adapted, you know, whether it's whether you've got your first option in or there's someone involved, like,
absolutely,
you know, just
I understand that.
There's nothing that is going to kind of come of things.
Yeah.
From your perspective, you know, what are what does this look like for when you're picking up books? What are you looking for? Not that I think writers are necessarily writing for the screen when they're writing fiction, but is it just exactly that? Is it just kind of a wing and a prayer out there and who might be interested in how those projects get up?
Yes, and I think there has to be something in the story. Again, for me to kind of and not that I am the arbiter of anything in terms of story, but I personally look for something that hasn't been said in a book, an idea that's being explored that's kind of in the zeitgeist that has been neglected. So that needs to be part of it. But I think there's another part. I'm starting to learn that there needs to be something very universal, and it, as much as I speak about zeitgeist or what's happening right now, underneath that there has to be something that is always present. There has to be something deeply human that is going to be relevant next year, you know, like and in 5 years, I feel, because TV making is slow. And that's what I've learned through those two adaptation processes. You know, Melanie Cheng's book, astonishing short stories. And then all of a sudden that wave I missed the wave, you know, like we'd pitched it at the wrong time. And that was partly due to COVID and partly due to my other the Letdown season two and the FX project I was working, you know, stuff got in the way and kind of missed the moment. So it needs to, particularly when it's new, in new stuff, it needs to have something eternal in there as well to keep it relevant in potentially in 5 to 10 years when you get to make it. So I don't know what to look for anymore, you know, but it has to strike a chord, either the character or something in the story. For me, has to be something I haven't seen.
So, Alison, I want to move on to kind of you as a creative and your artistic career. And I want to ask a little about guilt first. You had a great interview with the writer Ash Davenport in Design Files, where you say, you know, that you're in the privileged position where you get to practice your craft and make something that you believe in, and that is a way that you have kind of navigated around your feelings of guilt. And I want to ask how you got to that point, and can you just teach us all to practice saying that to ourselves, please?
I don't know if it, I gave that interview at a very particular time when I had just made season two of The Letdown, and that was that. I don't think that's going to be my whole career. Yeah. Like, to burst that bubble.
Damn it.
I know. I damn it for me too. But there are other pressures. There's survival kicks in, doesn't it? And I worked nonstop during COVID. Brutally, and had a little kid at home, homeschooling, and the guilt was, you know, off the charts. And they were survival jobs, and some good stuff came out of some really great stuff came out of them for me, but it was an incredibly challenging time. So the reality of I can't say that to myself all the time, but I, but anyone with family, you know yourself, you got to do what you got to do to keep paying the bills. And sometimes you just have to sit with the guilt. And I think the guilt was somewhat assuaged during that period because I knew, you know, my partner's an actor. There wasn't a lot that he could do. I knew it was on my shoulders to keep this family financially healthy, so I did what I had to do. But I am conscious of making choices. I think after COVID, after all the lockdowns, and you know, I have reassessed a lot, and I am really conscious of. I was in my early career too as a theatre practitioner, because I knew I could go and work in a cafe. It's not not a big deal. I've got other ways I can pay bills, I guess, is what I'm saying. So I had it in my early years where I had nothing to lose. That kind of like, I will choose projects. I will say, I will audition for stuff, and I will, if I get offered, I will say yes to the projects that mean something to me. Mm. And that sounds weirdly, I don't know, arrogant or something, but I was happy to let go of some things that that didn't tick that box for me, because it's very consuming, and it's something that I need to learn how to manage, particularly with a family. Mm. It's incredible the work I do, that my personality means that it's really consuming. Whether I'm sitting here writing, I am living. I'm living what I'm writing, and as an actor, I'm living what I'm playing. You know, so it's a really bizarre career. So it has to. I have to find some value, and it can't just be for me. I have to go, what's this asking? What questions is this piece asking? Is it offering something more than just a, you know, and a good story is enough sometimes. Like, is it a great story? Great. Mm. That's enough. But it has to be doing something more than just, is it a, I want it to do something more than just put money in my bank account. Because it costs a lot emotionally and psychically, I think.
From the outside and what you're describing, which is multiple projects, really kind of extraordinary timelines, the juggle of family and the different kinds of work that you do, how do you manage that? Do you have certain things in place, are certain days for certain work? Is this, you know, how big is the support crew? What does your kind of weeks and months look like, Alison, and how do you do it?
I am no pin-up girl for how to do it well. I am really not that person. I am quite chaotic. I think the secret to how I've been able to do it, and I wouldn't say I do it well, again, I don't do it well, is by having a partner who really co-parents. So I don't, I still feel all the guilt of being, of working really hard. But I do have someone else who works really hard on that front. That is a big part of it. So be careful who you procreate with.
is your takeaway.
My takeaway. Absolutely. I think I'm learning to be better at this. I'm learning to not push myself till I'm broken, which I have done many, many times. So I'm starting to go, okay, I don't have to give 100% to everything I'm doing. Mm. It's okay to be a little bit rubbish at some things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm rubbish at many things, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to give everything and leave myself completely depleted. I'm starting to learn that. Don't know how I'm going, putting it in practice, but I am starting to learn that. I don't have advice really on how to juggle all this stuff, because I think it's really specific to the individual in our worlds of that don't have any kind of order in terms of our work. I would just try to encourage people to look after themselves.
One of the things that you have kind of referred to a couple of times is both collaboration and the industry. And I think I saw this in numerous interviews you've given as well, about the kind of network of people, actors, producers, et cetera, within the industry. And one of the things we talk about on the podcast in Writing World is being a good industry citizen, you know, kind of being supportive of others, making those networks, not being afraid of the word networking, et cetera. How do you do it, or kind of what does it look like to be a good industry citizen in the creative arts that you're involved in?
I think ethics is key to how I want to practice in this industry. I've had some really challenging experiences, and I've come out of those experiences realizing that there's a value system that I want to that that I'm not going to compromise. And that is to do with how I treat people I work with. And that's really key. That's it for me. It's about kindness and respect and honesty. And I haven't always been good at being honest. And I haven't, I haven't had great boundaries, I would say. So I've allowed myself to drown sometimes. But now being a good citizen, I think, is being clear with people, you know, and also not, also really actively trying to, yes, support people, but be honest about the experiences. So not sell some, you know, I get nervous, and this has been, thank you for having listened to your podcast. I don't feel like this podcast is myth making. And it's a bit like going back to that thing of performers jumping straight back into work after 2 weeks and going, yeah, you go, girl, like that kind of stuff. I'm like, oh God, no, give yourself some space, give yourself, you know, but I also know the realities is that you might not work then for 5 years, you know, but I think being honest about the experience of being a woman in the industry is really important. And if we talk to each other, there's this idea, I think a lot of our talk is reduced to gossip. People like to talk about women particularly as gossips, but I think it's the sharing of information that will support each other in the industry, and being honest about what we encounter in the industry and the barriers and also the positives. So that honesty and ethics is really key. Yeah.
Thank you. What are the things you're allowed to tell us that you're working on at the moment that are making you excited? Or that are coming up for you that we might be able to see soon?
Well, I'm very excited to be walking back into the rehearsal room on Monday, actually, for the Melbourne Theatre Company. It's been a while and I'm quite nervous, to be honest. Don't know how I am vocally. I've been very quiet sitting at computers for a lot of years. So I'm really excited. I'm doing a show with Anne-Louise Sachs, the artistic director there, called What If Only by Carol Churchill, who is a master. It's a double bill with another Churchill piece, which is quite exciting. I think that's a really interesting thing for audiences potentially to see two shows in one night. And mine is only 20 minutes. So, you know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's also exciting to me.
Yeah. Talking about efficiency.
Yeah, exactly. And having a family and working in this industry. I won't be out all night and, there's so many pluses to that. And it's theatrically, it's a form I'm not used to. It's not a narrative arc. It's the kind of exploration of an idea. So it has a lot of theatrical possibility, and I'm very excited about that, because in TV, just to go back full circle, things can become very formulaic. Mm. And it's nice to step back into that world where the imagination can really just I look forward to that. Writing wise, things are in I've got some things in development, but I'm, to be honest, I'm pens down right now. I've got a glorious US collaborator who I've been working with for years now, and we have a project that we're not pushing because of the strike, and I'm 100% behind the strike. And I'm in I should say that no judgment to those people who have to keep working here in Australia particularly, because I do voiceovers and I can pay the bills. Mm. So it's easy for me to go, I'm pens down and in full support. But it's a really important strike. It's a really important fight. Mm. So I'm not pushing that. And there's another piece that, oh my gosh, this is very, this has, you know, been very restorative of my writing soul. I have been working with Back to Back Theatre on a show that, because they're wanting to move into screen, and I just think they are the bee's knees. They are just the greatest. They're just such great human beings and such extraordinary artists. Mm. That again, it's kind of been so exciting to explode ideas of formula TV formula and to walk into a space where they don't play by any rules in there. It's very exciting to be working in that space, and just following other people's ideas and kind of, and being more of a helper, I guess, rather than a generator of the story. It's working off the offers that I get in that room. It's been incredibly exciting for me. So that's who knows where that will go. We've written the Bible.
So excited to have all this new vocab in my brain. It's amazing.
It's nuts, isn't it? Why are we calling it a Bible? Yeah, for starters?
But anyway. It's great. It works for me. That sounds like an incredibly kind of nourishing hard work, but interesting time coming up for you. Yeah. Alison, before I let you go, I would keep you for another 7 hours, but I won't. Can you perhaps share some advice for the writers listening? Advice about telling stories that you have learned over your time, or perhaps the advice that you share most or find most useful?
Gosh, that's a big question, isn't it?
It is, really, isn't it? If you can give me that in 10 words or less, that'd be great. No.
I think the thing I keep coming back to is truth. Truth is the most interesting thing. Not to say go and write, docos. I'm just saying, the human experience in its truest form you can write it in is always interesting to me as a reader, and always the most nourishing as a writer, I find as well.
Mm. And finally, Alison Bell, can you recommend to us a debut book, any time or any genre that you have enjoyed?
Look, we've mentioned Melanie, her novel, Room for a Stranger. Mm. It's so assured. It's so quiet and honest. That word I am obsessed with. I love what you guys are permitted to do in novel writing. I personally love pretty quiet internal books, and maybe it's because of the industry I'm in that asks us to externalize everything. But Melanie's work tonally is quite unique, gentle, incredibly humane. The empathy in that book is extraordinary. And it's not, I also love it because it's a contrast to what my industry constantly goes on about, which is, is this a sexy story? And I'm like, no, this is not a sexy story. This is a profound story of human disconnection and connection. And that's what I'm interested in. No offense, Melanie. I'm sure you're writing some sexy stories, but it's
absolutely,
it's just about humans, and it's so beautifully crafted. So that's my, yeah.
Melanie was one of our very first guests 6 years ago on the podcast. So that's beautiful.
Wow.
Round circle to come back to. Alison Bell, it's been an absolute joy. I've so been looking forward to this conversation and completely and utterly delivered. And I could have done another 2 hours. So thank you so much for joining us on the First Time Podcast.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.